Today's scripture reading is from the Gospel of Thomas. Jesus said, "The seeker should not stop until she finds. When she does find, she will be disturbed. After having been disturbed, she will be astonished. Then she will reign over everything." And Ursula Goodenough's William James. At bottom, the whole concern of religion is with the manner of our acceptance of the universe. The manner of our acceptance. It can be disappointed and resentful. It can be passive and acquiescent. Or it can be the active response we call assent. When my awe at how life works gives way to self-pity because it doesn't work out the way I would like, I call on assent. The age-old religious response to self-pity, as in, "Why, Lord? Why this? Why me?" And then, "Thy will be done." As a religious naturalist, I say, what is, is, with the same bowing of the head, the same bending of the knee, which then allows me to say, blessed be to what is, with thanksgiving. To give assent is to understand, incorporate, and then let go. With the letting go comes that deep sigh we call relief, and relief allows the joy of being alive at all to come tumbling forth again. Assent is a dignified word. Once it is freely given, one can move fluidly within it. When the response elicited by the epic of evolution are gathered together, several religious principles emerge that can, I believe, serve as a framework for global ethos. We are all, each one of us, ordained to live out our lives in the context of ultimate questions, such as, why is there anything at all rather than nothing? Where do the laws of physics come from? Why does the universe seem so strange? My response to such questions has been to articulate a covenant with mystery. Others, of course, prefer to respond with answers, answers that often include a concept of God. These answers are, by definition, beliefs, since they can neither be proven nor refuted. They may be gleaned from existing faith traditions or from personal search. God may be apprehended as a remote author without present-day agency, or as an interested presence with whom one can form a relationship, or as a pantheistic inherent in all things. The opportunity to develop personal beliefs in response to questions of ultimacy, including the active decision to hold no beliefs at all, is central to the human experience. The important part, I believe, is that the questions be openly encountered, to take the universe on. To ask why are things as they are is to generate the foundation for everything else.
This summer, the Presbyterian Church USA held its General Assembly in Portland, and the Assembly approved a measure that started at this church. Southminster Session sent an overture to Cascades Presbytery requesting it to endorse the Clergy Letter Project and send the overture to the General Assembly for approval. And it did so. And at the General Assembly, before 70 or so committee members, our own Kathy Huddleston advocated for the overture with an eloquent and elegant speech. You can read her speech on my blog. And the committee approved the measure by 60 to 10 or something, and then went on to the General Assembly of the plenary, where it was approved by a large margin. And the Clergy Letter Project was the dream of one individual, Michael Zimmerman, a professor of ecology who is now the vice president of academic affairs at Evergreen College in Olympia. And Michael Zimmerman has been on the front lines of the battle against alternative facts for a long time, especially in matters relating to science and teaching creationism or intelligent design in public schools as science. And he thought if he could get churches and their leaders, particularly clergy, to publicly sign a letter and to go on record as supporters of science, particularly evolutionary theory, then it might help in the battle for the hearts and minds of people of faith. And since he began the project in 2006, over 13,000 clergy have signed the letter. The letter was endorsed this year by the Presbyterian Church USA General Assembly. I just want to read the text to you. Within the community of Christian believers, there are areas of dispute and disagreement, including the proper way to interpret Holy Scripture. While virtually all Christians take the Bible seriously and hold it to be authoritative in matters of faith and practice, the overwhelming majority do not read the Bible literally, as they would a science textbook. Many of the beloved stories found in the Bible, the creation, Adam and Eve, Noah and the Ark, convey timeless truths about God, human beings, and the proper relationship between Creator and creation, expressed in the only form capable of transmitting these truths from generation to generation. Religious truth is of a different order from scientific truth. Its purpose is not to convey scientific information, but to transform hearts. We, the undersigned, Christian clergy from many different traditions, believe that the timeless truths of the Bible and the discoveries of modern science may comfortably coexist. We believe that the theory of evolution is a foundational scientific truth, one that has stood up to rigorous scrutiny and upon which much of human knowledge and achievement rests. To reject this truth or treat it as one theory among others is to deliberately embrace scientific ignorance and transmit such ignorance to our children. We believe that among God's good gifts are human minds capable of critical thought, and that the failure to fully employ this gift is a rejection of the will of our Creator. To argue that God's loving plan of salvation for humanity precludes the full employment of the God-given faculty of reason is an attempt to limit God, an act of hubris. We urge school board members to preserve the integrity of the science curriculum by affirming the teaching of the theory of evolution as a core component of human knowledge. We ask that science remain science and religion remain religion, two very different but complementary forms of truth. That's the clergy letter, endorsed this summer by the Presbyterian Church USA. The Methodists beat us to it a few years ago. It's relevant and it's timely. Less than 2 weeks ago, on February 1st, Groundhog's Eve, the Texas State Board of Education ignored the recommendations of a panel of educators and scientists to remove creationism from its standards in 2009 in Texas. Since then, science teachers are required when teaching evolution to spend time offering alternative creationist junk science as part of the curriculum. So every year, actual scientists recommend that the board stop this nonsense. The board, made up of politicians, refuses these recommendations and panders to religious fundamentalists. You can read the story on the Texas Freedom Network website. The Texas Freedom Network is a watchdog group monitoring far-right issues, money and leaders such as those who promote junk science in public schools. Science is under attack in the United States. If we did not have grassroots organizations such as the Texas Freedom Network or the Clergy Letter Project, and the awareness and activism that these and other organizations bring to the public, it could be much worse, and not only in Texas. So thank you, Southminster, for standing up for science. Now, as part of my contract with you as a minister, I receive 2 weeks per year of study leave, for which I am very grateful. And they're cumulative up to 3 years. And since I only used 1 week per year over the last 2 years, I have 4 weeks to use this year. And study leave is like a personal retreat. It's not vacation. It's feed the soul and mind time. And I spent last week at the Manuka Conference Center near Corbett, which is owned by the First Presbyterian Church of Portland. And I spent it reading and planning the worship service for 2017. In March, I'm going to take a study break. I'm going to go to the West Star annual meeting. That's the Jesus Seminar group. And I'm deciding yet how to use the two remaining weeks this year. But this past week, as I planned the worship services, I decided to connect them with the reading of the Bible cover to cover project in 2017. And so I thought about a few things that I want to share with you to set this up. First, I want to have a conversation with you about what the Bible is and isn't. What does the Bible do for us? What did it used to do for us? How has our view of it changed? How do we read it? Why do we read it? And why do we meet once a week and read selections from it in worship? And I'm not asking that dismissively. I'm asking what our relationship is with this book or this collection of books. And is this relationship evolving? And those questions will be ongoing. Second, I want to have a conversation with you about what is reliable information. What's the scientific method? How do we navigate through misinformation and disinformation from those in power? I'm confident that the way to sustain resistance to fascist movements is through evidence-based information and public knowledge, as opposed to private beliefs and partisan politics. And this applies to politics, and it applies to religion. I've discovered in my nearly 25 years of ministry with my four congregations and with the larger church that many people would rather believe than know. And this is not just in the context of church, but in the context of politics as well. We would rather believe things about ourselves than know the truth about ourselves. For instance, in American politics, it is seen as patriotic to believe that Americans are exceptional. We're more moral than those people in other countries. Our leaders would never do things that leaders in other countries might do. Saddam Hussein may gas his own people, but our leaders would never do anything similar. They engage in terrorism, not us. When this myth of American exceptionalism is challenged by evidence, the evidence is dismissed in favor of belief. Our leaders would never do that. I can't believe that would ever happen. Those who provide evidence to the contrary, to beliefs, are labeled as traitors, unpatriotic, in the old days, communists. In religion, it happens this way. When evidence is presented about biblical scholarship, for example, that shows that the doctrines of the church, such as virgin birth or miracles or resurrection of Jesus, are human creations, and the evolution of these doctrines can be traced historically, the evidence is dismissed in favor of belief. I don't care what the biblical scholars say, this is what I believe. And that's what's happening with the Texas Board of Education. Those who bring biblical scholarship to the pulpit are criticized for hurting people's faith, disrespecting people's beliefs, and otherwise being mean. Now here's the deal. While it may feel good in the short term to believe naive and untrue things about ourselves, that we're exceptional and that our personal beliefs are more true than evidence, in the long run, it is not so good. We reap what we sow. If we sow beliefs as opposed to facts, we will reap leaders who will manipulate that. And I'm not just talking about current leaders. Obama, Bush, Clinton, Bush Sr., Reagan, Carter, Ford, Nixon, Johnson, Kennedy, Eisenhower, Truman, all the way back to Washington, have relied on the myth of American exceptionalism to cover a multitude of sins. The chickens have come home to roost with this latest character. As far as religious belief trumping truth, well, while the Texas Board of Education is the latest cartoon of this silliness, the fastest rising religious group in America, and especially in the Pacific Northwest, is the nuns, the nun-affiliated, not interested in your religion, thank you very much. And one of the reasons why is because religious beliefs, as they've been presented, are not credible. In seminary, we ministers learned quickly not to trouble our parishioners with scholarship because it would hurt their faith. If you challenge people's beliefs, they won't give money. We reap what we sow. Not all of my seminary professors were that way. The ones I liked best encouraged me to challenge those beliefs. So I want to have an ongoing conversation with you about what the Bible is and isn't, what constitutes reliable information. And third, I want to talk with you about why our beliefs are so hard to challenge. What is it about the power of belief that prevents us from seeing important truths about ourselves and about the world as it is? And of course, the point is to develop the courage to recognize and challenge our own beliefs and assent, in the sense of Ursula Goodenough, assent to the world as it is. Letting go of cherished beliefs can be painful, but most importantly, it is liberating, not only for ourselves, but for others as well. And interestingly, the Bible may be a wisdom resource in this effort to honestly scrutinize our beliefs. What beliefs do, whether these are beliefs are about us as individuals, as families, as religious people, or as Americans, is that they provide for us a world. They provide for us a sense of home. They provide a comfort, fort, the word from fortress, against chaos. Beliefs are our home. And because of that, information that counters our sense of home, our world, has to be dealt with. And if it counters our world too much, it's dismissed. The other option is that if it counters our world, then we receive it, and then we have to change our beliefs. But this world has to remain intact in order for the beliefs to remain intact. Now, beliefs aren't necessarily wrong. We all have them about different things. The challenge is, when our beliefs are challenged by evidence, what do we do? Do we accept the new evidence, or do we resist in order to keep our beliefs intact? And here's what I've seen in the Bible that I found helpful. The stories of the Bible, including the overarching narratives, can be seen as what happens when we lose our sense of home. What happens when our world crashes? That story is repeated again and again throughout the scriptures. The call of Abram in Genesis chapter 12. Leave your home, leave your family, journey to a foreign place. That's what Yahweh tells Abram to do. He's telling Abram, who he renames Abraham, to trust, to have courage, to leave home, to leave the fortress. Earlier, Adam and Eve are expelled from home. So is Cain. The Hebrews are enslaved and liberated, and their story is interesting. That liberation is seen as chaos. They complain while they're in the wilderness. They want to go back to Egypt because at least it was home. Throughout the Bible, we find story after story of people losing their home, losing their world, their fortress, their comfort, and needing in some way to respond to that. And these stories are, of course, imaginative stories, but they are compelling because they speak a truth to us. First, loss of home is painful. Loss of home is necessary. Loss of home initiates courage. Loss of home leads to a larger truth. Loss of home can lead to a gain of shalom, the beautiful Hebrew word shalom, peace, justice, wellness. Beliefs create a world for us, a home. They aren't bad. They serve a purpose. But when they no longer serve the purpose, or when they serve the purpose at the expense of the world as it is, they are no longer life-giving, and they need to be let go. The task of religion is to enable us to do that. That's what this is about. It isn't to mess up your faith as if that were an end in itself. It is to enable us to move to a wider, more liberating understanding of who we are so that we can see more clearly and thus work for a more just and peaceful world, for shalom. And since it's Charles Darwin's birthday, a nod to the great man who looked at evidence and determined that while humans wanted to believe that we were exceptional and qualitatively different from other animals, he challenged some pretty big beliefs. We are closer to apes than angels. His findings about natural selection challenged beliefs about the Bible's stories of creation, at least in a literal way. And of course, Darwin's findings were met with great resistance, and they still are, for example, the Texas Board of Education. But more than that, how does the story of evolution and the larger cosmological story of the universe itself, which is new information, is hitting us every day, how does that challenge our sense of home, and how can embracing it enlarge us? That's the question. That's the task of faith. That's the task of religion at its best. It's not a circling of the wagons around our creeds and our beliefs or our own private beliefs, but a courageous trust to engage the world as it is and as we are discovering it to be. That's what I want to do with you. That's what I do. That's who I am. That's who I am as a minister. That's what I've done. That's what I do. That's what I will do until I'm dead. And I'm looking forward to doing this with you as we read the Bible, perhaps with a different set of eyes than what we've used previously. But let's find a way to keep this conversation two-way, as well as a conversation shared among one another. Amen.